This is an interview with Clarence Thronson, who served with the Navy Construction Corps, known as the Seabees, during World War II. This interview is being conducted at the Mount Horeb Public Library at the following address, 105 Perimeter Road, Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, on the following date, Saturday, September 6th at 4 p.m. The interviewer is Jessica Williams. Today, I would like to start by talking about your background before you joined the military. And that is the first question on the sheet.
Year I was born?
Yes.
3/28/14. I'm old. 94 years old.
94 years young, some people.
And born on a farm, down south of Blue Mounts, where my folks were farmers. Mm-hmm. And they had 8 children, all born right there on the farm. And I was the 7th out of 8.
Wow.
I have one younger sister. I eventually wound up in Mount Horeb because I come to Mount Horeb to high school. And I'll have to say that my mother and father, was their names were Mr. and Mrs. Ada Thronson. They were pretty good people. In other words, they were successful in their day. And I've always been proud of them. I went to high school here in Mount Horeb. It was in the Depression. The Depression hit works here in 19. I started school in 1928. And the Depression come in 1929. And it just got worse and worse and worse. It was kind of a nickel and dime economy. I mean, nobody had any money, nobody. But we got along just fine on the farm because there was we raised our own food and everything like that. And after I got out of high school, in 1932, we were then in the depths of the Depression, and it didn't start to pick up until about 1936. And I was I tried to go to college. I went up to La Crosse to go to college, and I suppose at one time I was good in athletics, pretty good. I was a strong person. And everybody I was around in school, they thought I would be I'd make a good coach. And at that time, lacrosse was kind of maybe in the realm of little colleges, you know, the outlying to the university. They were kind of maybe the most prominent. So I went up there, but nobody advised me. I went up there and I took way too many credits. I took 16 credits, and I should have never done that. I should have went up there and maybe took 12. And then it was in the Depression, and I tried to make a living by setting pins at night. After I got through in the day, I set pins and got home about 11, 12 o'clock at night, and then back to school in the morning at 8 o'clock.
Can you tell us what you mean by setting pins?
In a bowling alley.
Oh, in a bowling alley.
Yeah, they got machines that set them now. You used to set them by hand.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I did. I made $5 a week. And then it cost $5 a week for room and board. But I was losing weight, and it was just a terrible struggle. And folks, they weren't college. They didn't understand college. You know, they were, if you got to be a farmer, hey, that's a number one profession, as far as they were concerned. I wasn't inclined that way. I wasn't going to be a farmer. I was the first one, by the way, that out of 8 children that went to high school, out of 8 children. I was the first one that ventured to high school. My younger sister also went to high school. But I was good in athletics, so that I had a reputation.
Yeah.
when I got out of high school. Really did. And I met my dear wife when we were freshmen in college.
Mm-hmm. Freshmen in high school?
Yeah, okay. Right. Mm-hmm. And I was green as a grass, you know, coming from the country. Went to country school. Mm-hmm. And used to have play days between country schools and so forth. And it was in a time when we'd come to town on Saturday night with the eggs and trade for groceries. That was my folks. But there's where I, then when I started school, then I met a gal by the name of Delma Merlin. Mm-hmm. And she seemed to be terribly interested in me, and I couldn't figure out why, because after all, I didn't know her. But we got acquainted, and we became sweethearts in high school. And during the time after the after I graduated from high school, there was I didn't have any. Well, I went fooled away 1 year in college up at La Crosse. And then I, in that 4 years, I spent one winter in Chicago, and I went to what you call diesel school. I was trying to improve myself, but times were tough, tough to get, you know, to do anything with. And then I worked in a cream or for a collecting cream. And off and on in those years. And finally, I got an offer of a job as a timekeeper for a contractor. Mm-hmm. And I was to get, I got $24 a week for to be a timekeeper. Mm. And the reason I got to be the timekeeper is because I could print in indelible ink. And they had big white sheets. It was during the time when the government was trying to create work for as many people as possible. And we had big sheets like this, and I'd put their names in and how much they withheld and their wages and everything like that, and kept track of the payroll. Well, I didn't have a car or anything like that, and so... I had to depend on my getting to, my first job was up at Marathon City, Wisconsin. It's, I suppose about 10 or 12 miles west of Wausau on Highway 29. Mm-hmm. And we had a job, a grading job. That's earthwork from the Marathon City to Little Chicago. And I went up there as a timekeeper. Well, I had a foreman by the name of Freisleben. He was a hard-nosed German. And he thought my job was way too easy because I got done too quick. So when he thought I was done with the payroll, he'd come in and we stayed in a hotel. Mm-hmm. We paid $5 a week there, too. Room and board. And he'd come into town and get me, and he'd take me out on a job, and then I had to help him. So that summer then, when I was helping him, I don't know what you know about what's set in grade, but you have to set the road grade, you know, and then you have to take the humps off and level. And so he taught me all that. And so by the time I got done that summer, it was terribly dry in 1936. And I had a little knowledge, a diesel knowledge, and the, up there in that country was in granite country. And the dust was a lot of granite in it. And it just kind of ate up the motors in the car, in the equipment. Well, one a tractor got so it didn't have any power anymore. So it was up there out in a, you know, long ways away from. If you haul it away, you had to haul it on a lowboy, you know, if you were going to get it fixed. So the boss brought up the equipment, changed, put a new motor in, and Freisleben really didn't understand what it was, but I had gone to diesel school, so I knew kind of what was going on. So we tore the motor down and put in the new motor, and in about a day and a half, we had it running again with full power. And that was kind of one of the first pluses that when my boss started to look me over and wondered, how come that young fellow knows that, you know? So he was kind of impressed. And then he got impressed too because this German that I worked with, you know, I kind of got towards the end of the season, and I got I probably had as much knowledge about moving dirt as he did. The next spring, my boss had work down in the middle of Illinois. By that time, I had bought a $125 secondhand car, and he thought so much of me that he sent me ahead of everybody else down there, all alone, down to that job down in Illinois. And I went down there. There was machinery there and everything like that, and I put all the machinery, set the machinery up and got it all ready to go and everything, and laid out a pipeline 2 miles from the creek up to the where the brought water up to the place, because that's the way we sprayed, had to spray the water on the road in order to compact it. And had that all done, and I started moving dirt. And then my old foreman come. Well, it was supposed to be his job. But of course he wouldn't leave me alone. I was still timekeeper and everything like that, but I was doing a lot more. And then they raised my wages to $42 a week because I was doing as much as the foreman. And we operated that job two shifts a day. The Freisleben, he went to work at 4 o'clock in the morning. The equipment went to work at 4 o'clock. I come out at 12 o'clock and run the second shift. And we had a great success, had a nice summer. And apparently the boss must have made some money. And so we got the job done, and I got back up here to Mount Horeb and to my sweetheart and so forth. I suppose it was in October or somewhere along there, and my boss gave me a $300 bonus. So I put the money in the bank, and we got married. and that was in 1937. Mm-hmm. Got married on Thanksgiving Day in 1937. My wife always said that was the most foolish thing in the world you could ever do. Why take one holiday away when, when we could have had another one? But we did. We got married in 1937, and on the 25th, of November, and it was Thanksgiving. And then it was in the days when, you know, I suppose you know about when people work, if they get out of work, they get compensation for 27 months or whatever they do, I don't know. But in those days, you didn't get that. You had to be on your own, you know. And that winter then, Delma was my wife's name. She rented a place in Madison, and we paid $30 a month for the place for It was furnished. And got towards, oh, we moved in there, I think, in January or somewhere. I don't know, December or January. I don't remember the details now. But anyhow, when it was getting towards spring, I thought the $30 a month was going, was chewing up my money a little too fast. So I happened to be out here at the Mount Horeb, and there was a fellow who owned a little house out here on 78, on the going towards Black Earth. And he said, "You want to rent my house? How much? $15 a month." So I went back and told Donald we're going to move to Mount Horeb. We bought a ton of coal. They had one of those middle-of-the-room furnaces in the basement, and about a ton of coal. Put it in the basement. We moved out here in, I don't know, March or April. I don't remember. Well, maybe March, I guess. Anyhow, we lived there then. And then when I got married, my father-in-law was in the bargain. Mm-hmm. He lived with us. So he lived with us all the time we lived together, huh, until he passed away. Wow. So
did you get along with him?
Oh yeah, I did. He thought the world of me. He thought I was just the greatest. Mm-hmm. He was a farmer, mm-hmm, and he didn't know anything about what I did, but he knew that I run big equipment and stuff, mm-hmm, like that, and so forth. And then as the years went by, I continued to work for this same contractor, and he had work in Illinois more than anything else, and all that time then, from then until, oh, I think it was in 1942 or so, then he sold his equipment to the government. And we were in Pearl City, Illinois. That's where we finished up our work, in Pearl City, Illinois. It could have been 41, but anyhow, yeah, I believe it was. So we loaded all the equipment on boxcars, mm-hmm, and shipped it, and it come up here to Badger Ordnance. And in the deal, my boss sent me with the equipment. And so they were supposed to employ me then, because, so then I worked at Badger Ordnance, I don't know, I suppose it might have been a year and a half or so. But then the contractor that I was acquainted with, they got the contract to do all the blacktop up there at Badger Ordnance. Mm-hmm. I got drafted then in 42, mm-hmm, and that's when I thought I would. I knew I'd had a lot of experience, and I ought to try. I wasn't going to go in as a grunt. I was going to. I had a chance to enlist and get a better berth. So I did. I enlisted then in the Seabees, and I got to be a first-class machinist mate. And then I got deferred, because that work up there at a Badger Ordnance, which was a for the, you know, plant for the making powder up there. So I was probably the most important person in the idea of that blacktop up there. So I got deferred until the end of that work, until that work was done. And so then in Navy Day in 1943, my wife took me to Madison, and got on a train, and it took us to Camp Peary, Virginia. Okay. And whether you believe it or not, my wife thought that was the worst day of her life. Yeah. So I arrived at Camp Peary with a group of 570-some men. And we were assembling there in the evening. They moved us into barracks, mm-hmm, 24 people, 24 persons to a barracks. And the bunks were all there and everything. And then, of course, well, they issued our gear later on. But that first day, now you can tell how lucky I am. That first day, we were assembled. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening, and they were going to pass out duty. And who was supposed, the first name out of 575 people was called? Clarence Thronson, Sergeant of the Guard. Of course, I didn't know military from anything, you know. It was this foreignness, you know, of trying to speak Chinese. I didn't know segum about military. So needless to say, it was a shock. But as all things do, they come and go and they pass. But I was sergeant of the guard and assembled, and they were. It was a training camp, and so they had eight people guards, and I was sergeant of the guard, and they placed those at intervals around camp. Then, you know, this is training now. Well. This is kind of an interesting incident. I had a fellow, one of the fellows was a boy from Mississippi. And, of course, in those days, you know, colored versus white was, you know, kind of sparks, you know. Well, it happened so that this kid from Mississippi got posted on the trip coming from town where they'd been out on liberty, and they were coming back to camp. And a part of the training was then that, you know, you had to show your ID in order to be accepted, you know. At any point, if you wanted to get into camp, you had to show your ID. Well, he was on the road going to town, and it was about, 12:30 at night or something like that, and pretty soon I hear the call, Sergeant of the Guard. And now what? I wanted to be Sergeant of the Guard like a hole in the head, you know. But I went up there, and here they had, four or five colored people. And the guy from Mississippi had them stymied.
Oh, boy.
They wouldn't... Didn't want to, he talked Southern, you know. They weren't going to show him their ID. They were going to get in without showing them. Well, he had a make-believe rifle, but he had it at ready, you know. And so I come up, and these colored boys were staying there, and what's going on? What's wrong? He said, I asked them to put their ID on the deck, he said, so I could identify him, and he said, they won't do it. So I said to the boys, I said, I don't know. Is that so hard to do? You know, why don't we just show your IDs and get in, and we won't make no big fuss about it. It worked.
Good.
Right. So I got over that hump. And then towards morning, somewhere in the morning, one of the fellows that was on guard, he just set his rifle over and he went to the bathroom. I think it was about, 3:30 or so in the morning. And of course we had Shavetail, you know, was in charge, Goldbraid in charge, you see. And I don't know how come he ever got out of the office, but anyhow, he found this rifle standing up against him. And the guy wasn't on guard. You know, you can't leave your post. That's the idea, and it's training. Well, he come back, it was getting towards 5, 6 o'clock in the morning then when our shift was over, and then Goldbraid in charge, into the office. And he said to this kid that had put his rifle up, you know, he said, I'm going to put you on report. Well, I don't, what the hell is put you on report? I didn't know what that was, and neither did he. Well, except that it sounded quite ominous, you know. And, I kind of soft-talked. He was a second lieutenant. So I kind of sweet-talked him, and I said, well, you know, this is the first night, his first night. He was from Springfield, Illinois. I said, he's never been in the military before. I said, that'd be pretty drastic. I don't know what put on report means. But I said, it sounds to me like it'd be quite drastic. So, okay, you're in training. So he let it go. Right. So that was my first night in the military.
Oh, my goodness.
Already interesting.
Uh-huh.
Right, yeah. Well, we were in Camp Perry training then. We had to had boot camp, you know. And, of course, they march you every day, you know, and that's supposed to get you in the military. You know, you're supposed to understand military. You've got to, you know, there's a chain of command there. And so that was what boot camp was all about. And a lot of marching and so forth. And I think we were in boot camp for about 5 weeks or so, or something like that. And then I got, we got leave after boot camp. And we must have boot camp. It might have lasted longer than that, because then when we got leave, I came home for Christmas. And we had an unfortunate, terribly unfortunate thing happen. I had a brother with a family of two children. He was on he was farming down on the home farm. And he had TB and he passed away while I was home. I had to extend my leave for a few days in order to, you know, have the funeral and all things like that. And then back to Camp Perry. And we were from the Camp Perry, they sent us to Norfolk, Virginia. And we were supposed to build barracks. And it rained and rained and rained and rained and rained all. So we spent a lot of time in our barracks. We didn't accomplish much. In fact, I found out that they were building, putting pontoons together, so I volunteered to, they could do that in the rain. It was a little difficult to be building barracks in the mud, but they were building those pontoons in the water. So I volunteered, and I run a crane for a while to lift those sections down so that they could build a pontoon. They built pontoons. I suppose they were maybe about a third the size of a flight deck. And then they had those up to the dock. So it made more dock. You see what I mean? After they thus got then into the spring then, and they wanted to, they were all, the whole crew, we had a big outfit there. And they were going to build a catapult deck. So they had to haul in material and level that off. A catapult deck, I'm saying, is the same size as a aircraft carrier. In other words, they catapult planes in the air and they arrest them. Catapult them and arrest them. And they built a deck about the size of a carrier. And And so they had to haul dirt in and so forth and grade it and so forth. And they were had all these men all the way around, all over, like a bunch of ants. And one day they hauled in a bulldozer on a lowboy. And they had a half stripe there, right, half stripe. I mean, he wasn't a second lieutenant yet. He was just in between. Mm-hmm. And he was walking around there, and I guess we were all loitering, I guess, or whatever. And he was walking around there, and he'd go one direction and then another direction. And pretty soon he wasn't very far away from me. And he says, does anybody here know how to get that bulldozer off of that lowboy? Mm-hmm. I do. So I went up and started the bulldozer and backed it off. And hey, we got somebody that knows something around here. And then he must have thought I knew something, because then he took me out in the country, a ways away, and we found a kind of a sand pit, and he said, wanted to know if we could haul sand out of there and how to do it. Mm-hmm. Well, it was kind of an abandoned sand pit. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, if you want to get a crane with a clam bucket to load, I said, if you want to bring that bulldozer out here, I'll run the bulldozer and I'll push that sand up so that the crane can load trucks, mm-hmm. and they can haul it to the site. And then after we get it over to the side, we'll take the bulldozer over there and I'll level it off. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we did. Mm-hmm. And when we got them, they had a steel deck they laid down. Mm-hmm. The catapult, arrestor and the catapult was in the middle. And you had a deck going this way and a deck going this way. And in the middle, you had the track to kick them off and catch them. But you laid from here that way and from here that way. You had four quarters. And when they went to lay the deck, which was, you know, I suppose about 20, maybe 24 feet from the center on both sides. I forget in all detail. But anyhow, I was in charge of one, and they gave me a crew. And there was another first class man over here and another one over here. And by the way, I had found a fellow that could run a blade, a motor grader. So, and I had somebody set stakes. So we got the area all leveled off. And this half stripe was watching. Well, anyhow, they assigned then four first class seamen to be the boss on each one of those. I was the boss on one strip, and my section went so well, I got done ahead of everybody else. Mm-hmm. Well, this half stripe's looking. How the hell does he do that? Well. Then after we got that done, you see that picture of about 75 men. They picked out 75 men and me along with them. And they had three chiefs, I guess. That's a class above me, but enlisted personnel. And we went to Florida to build another catapult deck. And but only the 75 men. We didn't have the great big crew. We had our own cook tent. We had our own cook. And so we were pretty well self-contained. And then we went down there and built a catapult. And it didn't take so long. And then we started coming up along the coast, and we built a catapult deck in New Jersey, and right on the ocean, right on the Atlantic Ocean. The Atlantic Ocean come when the tide come in, it was only about 150 feet away from our bunks, or where our tents. And so we built another catapult deck there. And it was, I don't know if you ever heard of Seal City, but that was a vacation area along the Atlantic coast in New Jersey. Used to go there on Liberty, by the way. And then they had a tavern there so you could drink beer. But we weren't there very long. We built, but while we were there, we enjoyed it very much because they had, when the tide went out, you could go out with a rake and rake clams out of the, and we'd get a pail of full of clams and clean them up or what, rinse them off, you know. Mm-hmm. Take them into the cook and he'd steam them open just a little bit like that. And we'd have clams. I thought that was the greatest. And we had a cook that, he was from La Crosse. How come he ever got to be cook for, and we got, I was trying to think of his name, it was Harry something. But he used so much oregano that you could smell the chow hall from miles away. I got so down on oregano that I just couldn't. I hardly ever ate meat. But in the service, in the Navy, the food was good. They had a salad every day, and always on the table you had oil, a jug of oil and a jug of vinegar. So you made your own, you know. But they had fresh fruit or a vegetable every day for every meal. At noon, not for dinner, for breakfast. But the food they had was healthy and good. Because a lot of fellows that were heavy when they come in, they're slimmed out. Mm-hmm. And the fellows that were this thick in the middle, they filled out. Mm-hmm. So they had food was just what you needed.
That's right.
But we got done in New Jersey, and we went to Rhode Island and built another catapult deck. And then we went to Maine and we built more. And we still had these. Well, it was gotten smaller because some, you know, they always drop out, or you know, and they never added any, and some of them dropped out because of one reason or another. You know, you never know. But so we were there on the East Coast for, I don't know, it was, I don't know, maybe it was, by the time we got done with building those catapults up and down the East Coast, it must have been about, 7 or 8 months. Mm-hmm. And then by that time, my Gold Braid was a second lieutenant. Mm-hmm. So he got moved up. Anyhow, he knew, I guess, that he was going to go to Okinawa. Mm-hmm. And so he was bound that I should go to Okinawa with him. So he took my jacket and kept it out of the swim so that nobody could get me, because it wasn't legal, but he did it. Uh-huh. And then in, I don't know, dates kind of escaped me a little bit, but anyhow, we headed for Okinawa and went on a troop ship, got to the Hawaiian Islands. When we left, I guess I'll have to just to relate this. This is not too sweet, but when we left, you know, where the Bay Bridge is, we were in Oxnard, California. And when we left there, why, you know, always when the ocean comes towards shore, it's rough. And so when we started out rough for the first. And I don't know whether everybody thought that you should eat a lot or whatever, but anyhow, I never see so many sick people in my life. It was just all over the ship. But anyhow, I was smart enough to get a top bunk wherever we went.
That is smart.
All right. And I don't know how come, but it seemed like people stood away so that I did get the top bunk. I don't know why, but I did. Wherever we went aboard ship, I always had a top bunk. And so many sick people, it was just, oh. There was, you know, there wasn't enough latrines. The showers and everything was full of vomit.
Oh, my. Yuck.
Yeah. Well, they didn't want them to use the side of the ship because they didn't know, you know, somebody would fall overboard. So they kept them. Well, anyhow, that wasn't this is not thrilling or anything like that, but it was... A new experience for me, let's put it that way. But I never did at all. I don't know whether I was immune to it or what. I never got sick. But anyhow, I got called duty the next day, and we had a big hose and hosed down everything. It was that bad. Right. And then we went to Hawaii, and we berthed there for, oh, I don't know, 10 days, I guess, or something like that. I think we were long enough then for a group of ships going farther so that we could be escorted from there on. And then, of course, it was the same thing as everybody heading for Okinawa or for the east was getting ships. Loading up with food and everything like that. Then from Okinawa, then when we left there, then we were escorted. We were in many ships in the middle and surrounded by aircraft and battleships. And when we stopped at Aniwetok for a little while, and apparently they had supplies there, and anybody then, before we hit for Okinawa, then apparently they took on whatever they needed, and then they escorted us to Okinawa. And when we got to Okinawa, there again, Okinawa, mud. It was, everything was mud. Okinawa, the wind blows, typhoons come, and there are no big trees, no big trees. They're all little trees that probably like berry bush, you know, or a berry or a cherry tree or something like that. Small vegetation. But there was a long hills. Miles, it seemed to me, but of course now I'm looking back, up till they got to the high part of the land. So it was a long ways. Well, they benched the hillside and had tents, you know. And there was 6 men to a tent. And then we slept on our own, we had our own cot. Then, and we slept on our own cot, and 6 men to a tent. And we were in charge of what you call Buckner Bay, a fellow with a general in the army by the name of Buckner got killed there when our fighting people were clearing the island. fellow, a general by the name of Buckner, got killed there, so they called it Buckner Bay. And it was, they had developed the port so that ships could come in. In other words, they had enough deep water. So ships like battleships and freighters and so forth could come in there and dock. And, of course, this bay was like this, and the water out here and so forth. And our outfit was in charge of the roads and to keep things up and so forth. And we patrolled the roads and things like that. We had our own chow hall and our own water supply and everything. Then's when Johnson got kind of in trouble with his mates because, well, now the officer, the gold braid I had, mm-hmm. he was a captain. Mm-hmm. So he was in charge. Mm-hmm. And whenever he wanted anything special, why, he'd have a runner come to my tent and I'd have to haul him around. And, of course, my friends, wasn't long before they started to call me Brown Nose. But it wasn't my fault. I had more experience and knew more about construction than anybody in that camp. I'd had it, you know, several years in construction already and around machinery and so forth. So I really did. I had it over everybody, and so that's why the commanding officer leaned on me. He didn't lean on his other gold braid or on his chiefs. Mm-hmm. I'd get a runner about 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. I drove the weapons carrier, and he was along. Mm-hmm. Needless to say, I didn't get a very good reputation.
Did you get a promotion?
No. I could have, but I didn't. I wanted to get the war over and go home mm-hmm. and get into construction mm-hmm. and earn money. Mm-hmm. By the way, I earned $155 a month for being a first class seaman. I sent home $105 and I kept 50 for myself in the service. Uh-huh. Because well, when we went on leave and so forth, I come home several times that one year because the commanding officer had my jacket, mm-hmm. and I wasn't doing anything. I was just laying around. Mm-hmm. And so I go to him and say, hey, why am I, you know, it's Thursday. 1 week we went up to New England to the football game and left on Thursday and got back on Monday. Then twice I come home on a weekend, Thursday, and got back on Monday. Mm-hmm. Well, every time, again, I was privileged because I come back after my leave was up, but nobody ever challenged me, so I never ever got punished. It was kind of like nobody knew I was there.
What do you mean you had your jacket?
A file.
Okay.
You know, you had a file probably that thick mm-hmm. of everything that I'd done. Mm-hmm. So he took that out and took it home, kept it in his.
So nobody else could.
Nobody else could take it.
Use
no. So that's how come I stayed with him all the time from Norfolk until we got discharged.
Wow.
He kept me.
What was his name?
Han, Lieutenant Han.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Did you keep in touch with him after the war?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wrote. I corresponded with him and 12 other people mm-hmm. until they all died.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I got notice from their wife or their family that they had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and But I accomplished something out there on the island. We had two typhoons while we were there. The first one wasn't that bad. It was a lot of rain, a lot of rain, like it was pouring it out of a bucket, But the wind didn't get that high. But the second one was, it took several days for it to get really wound up. And we had several of those freighters that, Liberty ships in port that had brought supplies, from the States. And they were in port. There was, I think, three or four of them. I don't remember, except that they were out of business. They couldn't go out to sea. They didn't have power or something. So they sat there in the bay. And, of course, the storm come in off of the ocean. And the storm lasted about 3 days. It started and got more intense and more intense and more intense until it got to the height, and then it started, dribble off. But after the storm was over, there was three of those 600-foot freighters up on dry land. Now, everybody in the world can call me a liar, but I'm not. There was, I think there's a picture someplace about what the... And they were at least 200 feet from the water. And then, of course, there was no use for the refrigerators to run up there on the dry land. So we appropriated the food, sides of beef, and two truckloads of beer. And I remember the officer, we had the beer there in camp, and I said to him, I said, we either got to secure that beer or it isn't going to be around very long. So we built a fence around it about 14 feet high and put barbed wire all the way around it with a gate in it. And he had the key. So, well, he was going to be good to the people in camp, And he was going to give them a beer each day. But we had seamen along, We had, of course, you always had to have somebody do the work. And we had seamen along. And the young, 18, 19. And they were handing out a can of beer at breakfast. And those young kids would keep them until on Saturday night for a couple of weeks, and then they'd get drunk. So I had to quit that.
Well, that was discipline, that they
didn't
drink it in the morning.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was going to be good to them. So every morning at breakfast, you can take this home back to the camp, not necessarily to drink it. So you'd have, you'd be part of the fun, part of the goodies, So I had to cut that out. That didn't work. But I bet you if they haven't been cut up for iron, they're probably still there. I'll have to relate a little bit about Okinawa when we were there. There wasn't a... And I was pretty much all over the southern half of the island. There wasn't a building standing, not one building standing. The war had leveled everything. Now, I don't know where the men folks were, but we didn't see many, and I'm talking about when we were around, if we drove around on the roads and so forth, and The capital of Naha was about, oh, I don't know, 20 miles away from where we were, and we drove over there one day, never saw a soul. The only thing we'd see of the natives were that they had little, I don't know whether you know what a grub hoe is, but they, you can dig the earth with it. It's got a blade on about like that. Mm-hmm. And they had sugar beets, mm-hmm. or root vegetables. And the women were doing that. Mm-hmm. They were keeping the weeds away from out of the vegetables and so forth. And they usually had two guards, a man on each side of the garden, or the yard, or where they were had the food. Mm-hmm. So they had a men. Bosses, I suppose, and the women doing the work. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of interesting. We, we had a cook shack where we ate, you know. We had that, that went up first. It was a Quonset hut, quite a pretty good sized Quonset hut. Mm-hmm. And when the cooks had, you know, fat left over or something like that that wasn't very clean or anything like that, but they put it in a 5-gallon bucket and set it outside, and every night if they had any, they would disappear. The natives, mm-hmm. I suppose there was something to eat, you know. But one thing I accomplished when I was there, I thought I did pretty good at, before I come, I don't know whether you know what coral is, but coral is a lime-type rock, mm-hmm. and it's kind of like your fist. It's not layers. I don't know, you drive around the country now and you see lime rock and it's layers? Mm-hmm. That's not in layers. It's mm-hmm. just in every kind of direction, mm-hmm. but that's what's called coral, and it's lime. Difficult to handle. Mm-hmm. Well, prior to us being there, they were trying to crush that stuff and make a roadway out of it, mm-hmm. you know. And, they had a struggle. Struggle. And one day, the commanding officer, Mr. Hahn, and I were riding around, and we were right on the ocean beach, you know. And it occurred to me that maybe we could do better. Where we were trying to park our equipment and our jeeps and everything like that was a big pile of mud. And it did rain a lot. So I said that one day we were riding around, and I said, hey, let's go down to the beach. I said, I'd like to go down there and see if there's any sand down there, you know, mm-hmm. sand beach. Mm-hmm. So we did. We found a road and went down to the beach. Sure. They had a sand beach there, and, you know, when the tide went out, hey, it was about a half a mile of sand out there. And, of course, tide come in, it covered it up. Mm-hmm. And I said to Han, I said, you know, I think we could get out of the mud. If you wanted to get some trucks and a loader, a drag line or something to load the trucks with, and a bulldozer to level it off, and I said, I think we can get out of the mud. He requisitioned it right away. Mm-hmm. So we got trucks and an equipment and a roller and a crane to load them and so forth, and started hauling sand off the beach. Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't know how we could do that, he said, because the tide come in every day. Mm-hmm. He thought, that won't make any difference. I said, the water will do it good, I said. So we started hauling sand, and we had the spot that we were had open where we were using for our everyday, it must have been about seven or eight acres, maybe a little more or less, I don't know, but anyhow, we started to bring in sand. And I had them dump sand, and we leveled, and We hauled it in there and dumped it on top of the mud, and I know the guy said, I knew real well, you're nuts, you know. The hell you think you're doing? Mm-hmm. I said, you just wait. I said, we'll get it. Well, we covered the whole thing with sand, about, maybe 15 inches of sand, mm-hmm. and leveled it off, and it rained and rained, and that packed down. God, pretty soon everybody went driving across it with their jeeps and the weapons carriers and everything. It was just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then we even... in front of the tents, they even took sand and put it in front of the tents and around the chow hall. And hey, we were living in glory because we didn't walk in mud every day. Well, it wasn't very long before a Marine general come driving by and on his jeep, and in there he comes. Who's this camp? He says. Where's the commanding officer? And, okay, somebody went and found Han, our Captain Han, and he said, I want this camp for my Marines. He said, you can have your people move out of here. He said, I'll give you 10 days. So first he said he'd take half of it. Well, Han said, if we got to build another camp, he said, hell, take it all. So we did. We built another camp and got another site, and they had a ditch come running down through the middle, and everybody, what are we going to do with this ditch? We won't know. We fill it in, water will run through. We had thousands of barrels, empty barrels. So I said, well, we'll make a culvert. We'll just take those empty barrels and we'll weld them together, and we run the water under our camp. Mm-hmm. And then we built another tiers like that. And mm-hmm. and after the typhoon, we got all new tents. Mm-hmm. Because it rained so hard that you could see the sky through the tent, you know, in the typhoon. Mm-hmm. And so then when we went to move, then I said, well, we're not going to tear the tents all down. Let's just try to move them whole. Mm-hmm. Whoever lives in there, put all your stuff in your sea bags. And we had built wooden bottoms in them, you know, in the tents. And so they were livable, you know. And it was warm, of course, over there. So we got a couple of low boys, and we'd haul the whole tent. We'd got it framed, little frame around it, and we'd load it with a crane and put it on a tent, put it on a low boy, put the tent on a low boy, take it down to the new location, take it off and set it, move the whole camp, mm-hmm. new location. Mm-hmm. So I think I accomplished quite a bit of that, mm-hmm. and I accomplished that sand business and put everybody out of the mud. Mm-hmm. Then everybody was hauling sand mm-hmm. after that, mm-hmm. you know. So I made a mark, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
Yeah. And I had a lot of fun, too. There was other first-class men in charge of one thing or another. We had a first-class man by the name of Wortman. He was in charge, or supposed to be in charge, of heavy equipment. And they had that crane that we was using to load sand with, and God, it started to miss and just wouldn't run at all. And nobody knew what to do, and hell, you wasn't going to go to the States and get parts for it. You know, you had to do. So I knew what was wrong. Mm-hmm. It was the sparks were, it had a distributor cap, you know, that distributes the spark to the chamber, you know, the spark plug, you know, and it goes, where it goes around like that. And it's a cap with the, so I knew what was wrong with it. And I said, tell you what, to Whitman. You get me some airplane glue, and I said, I'll put you back in business. Mm-hmm. He did. Mm-hmm. He thought, why, you son of a bitch, he said, you know, you're nuts. So he did. He got me some airplane glue, and the distributor crack cap was cracked. Mm-hmm. So I took the airplane glue and a toothpick, and I just drew a line on the with the glue on both the inside and the outside, and then let it harden. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know, let it go, I guess. Of course, it was always warm, you know. So the next day, I said, here, you can put on your distributor cap now and go to work. And put it back on and fired away, and it run like a clock. So those were little things that stood out, you know. Well, there were many things, but when the typhoon hit, you know, everybody left camp. Or not everybody left, but a lot of them left camp and went to the caves, you know, and so forth. So that after the big typhoon, after it was over, we were short maybe, oh, I don't know, 40 people. And I remember Han come to me and he said, well, what do you think we ought to do? I said, well, hell, let's just wait a while. They'll probably all come back. They did. So that was also another quite a experience, let's put it that way. It was I can't say it was a fun thing, but it was something that I'll remember forever. You know what I mean? And I guess a satisfactory also that I accomplished something for and with other people. So that I thought that was.
Well, maybe this would be a good place to stop.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.